Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So here we are. I'm waiting with bated breath in my little office at my desk, waiting for Jay, aka Beans on Toast, one of the most colourful, charismatic fellows on the UK festival scene, and just in music generally. He's worked with everyone from Mumford and Sons through to just kind of releasing 10 or 11 of his own solo albums. He's just done his own book, Drunk Folk Stories. He's a funny guy, and he has been through it all, seen it, done it, and yes, got the medals and the trophy to show. So yeah, here we go. Let's have the AIDS set of festivals with Beans on Toast. And I should add, actually, sorry, Jay wanted me to tell you, if you're going to Glastonbury, then do make sure you check out Beans on Toast, 2 p.m. on Saturday on the Avalon stage. So yeah, you will hear a bit more about Glastonbury in the podcast, but 2 p.m. Saturday, Avalon, Beans on Toast. Yes, yes, yes. Here we are again in the podcast studio of Joy. And a couple of weeks ago, this brown envelope dropped through the DeBank postbox. And I thought, that's a fat wad of something. Sadly, it was a book. But happily, it was a book by Beans on Toast. It's called Drunk Folk Stories. And it kind of made me think, wow, Beans. Yes, Jay, the man who has played numerous of my festivals and pretty much every festival probably in the UK and the world, and we'd get him in. So welcome, Beans on Toast.
Thank you very much. I think we should give credit where credit's due as well for Dan amongst the pigeons, because it was him on Twitter that was like, why don't you get Beans on? And I was like, yeah, why not? I sent you the book. My mum sent it to you, actually.
Did she?
My mum sent out my book. So,
okay. Yeah. It came in an unmarked car, so I didn't recognise it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, no, big up to Dan for kind of pushing you forward. Obviously, you were on the hit list already.
I'm glad. And I've been listening and really enjoying the podcast, so it's an honour to be here.
Okay, you sat there last night and listened to 5 seconds of one.
I've got the tune down.
I wrote that tune.
Did you?
Yeah, it's a lazy boy tune. Okay, so the pride of Braintree, Essex, a child of the 80s, the meandering minstrel, it is Beans on Toast. We're going to kick off with a little true or false, if that's okay with you, just to get the listeners acquainted and you warmed up. Not that you need it. I was going to say true or false, and then this isn't even a true or false, but how many minutes should you warm Beans up for? 2 to 3 minutes, 3 to 4 minutes, or 5 to 6 minutes?
God, I have no idea. I don't actually eat them.
There is an official... You don't like beans?
Not really, no.
Oh, God. Right, man. Interview suspended.
Yeah. I'm more a spaghetti hoop fan, but...
Are you?
It just didn't have the same ring to it.
Even with a newborn, you're not sort of thinking cheesy beans on toast?
Yeah, like, she eats them, but yeah. I don't know. I'm sure it says on the packet how much you're supposed to warm them up for.
3 to 4 minutes. Just so you're
aware. If this is a cookery podcast, I'm in trouble.
Yes, it's the new table manners of Jesse Ware. Welcome along. true or false? You release a new album on the 1st of December each year.
True. which this year will be my 11th album.
And do you only release albums on your birthday?
I only have, yeah. It's just something that, there was no massive plan to it, but it's just something that happened. After the first album was ready by around my birthday. The next year there was another one ready about the same time. It was like, just put it out again. By the third year it was a thing. And it also feels like, it's sort of like, now it feels like my natural sort of output. It feels like, you know, I can quite relax and write an album a year. And it also means that I can just, you know, plan my years ahead. And I get to play the same festivals year in, year out, which not a lot of acts get to do. And I think one of the sort of like reasons for that is that, well, there's definitely more new material there. You know, there's a whole new album out each year. So it just keeps me constantly gigging, constantly writing, and constantly playing festivals, basically, which is what I love doing.
So. Yeah, and you haven't got a record label breathing down your neck going, it's March and it's due out in April, and you know you've got till December to...
Yeah, exactly. I know I generally record it like around September, and that gives me enough time sort of before September to write it, enough time post September to do what you need to do to get it out. But you know, if an album wasn't ready, or you know, I didn't feel like it, I wouldn't do it. You know, I've not really promised it to anybody. It's never been I never want to see it as a chore. It just always feels like the right thing to do.
But you have managed to do it for 10 years running.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, long may it continue. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, it's a digital world now, obviously, so you can put music out on any day. But what in the past, if it's been a Sunday, what happens?
Well, I think it's out when you say it's out, isn't it? If you put a poster up that says it's out 1st of December. Yeah,
it's out when it's on the racks of our price.
I mean, then it would obviously go in whenever, like Monday, or then move to, moved to Friday now, hasn't it? Okay. But
so you don't like beans on toast. You probably lied about when you're putting your albums out. Come on, mate. Right, okay. True or false, despite your track called Can't Get a Gig at Glastonbury, you've opened the Glastonbury Festival every year since 2005.
False. Fake news. Wikipedia. It's incorrect information on my Wikipedia, which says that I opened Glastonbury every year. I know where it came from, and I wish that I could change it. If anybody out there knows how to adapt Wikipedia, please do.
Isn't that the whole point of Wikipedia?
Also, I don't want to be the one that writes my own Wikipedia page. Surely it's, you know, it's written by the people, isn't it? But I think what happened is, years ago, I had like a pretty awful gig at Glastonbury where it was like 11 a.m. on Wednesday at like some tiny little tent. It wasn't awful, you know, it was still a gig, but ultimately it was like, and then when I saw the full lineup, I was actually the first act playing. So I just span it and was like, I'm opening Glastonbury. And it kind of got, you know, people was like, oh, wow, being on toes, opening Glastonbury.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's sometimes just what you say, isn't it? And that, I don't know, I guess that got a bit of press coverage. And somehow between that and the fact that I do play Glastonbury every year, somewhere on Wikipedia it now says that I open Glastonbury every year. And I don't even know what that means, how you would go about, like, I'm cutting the ribbon. I mean, I'm always there
How you doing?
It's open!
You could sit in the car park on Tuesday night and just strum your guitar three times and say,
There's an element of truth to that.
Are you normally there on a Wednesday?
Generally. I mean, cause I like last few years, from if you're playing, you have to get in early if you want to get your van in. So I'm mad keen on that. So I'll generally be, especially the years like this year when there's been a year off.
Yeah.
I'd probably go Super tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably go tomorrow if I could. I'll definitely be there early this year.
Okay. We'll definitely be recapping on Glasto in a minute. And apologies to anyone who gets bored of me talking about Glastonbury, but it's the greatest show on earth.
And it's close as well. If ever there's time to be excited.
Yeah. Three weeks or something. Okay, true or false, you've got in some right pickles at festivals over the years.
Enjoyable pickles. Fun pickles, but yeah, I guess.
100% true?
100% true.
Okay, true or false, Essex is not what people think it is.
That is definitely true. I think the, especially the further afield that you travel, people will believe that Essex is like what they see on TV, which is, you know, strange that anybody believes anything they see on TV, especially reality TV shows. But it's a huge county, Essex, and I've certainly growing up and didn't see anything like the TV show would have you believe. But I guess, you know, life imitates art to a certain extent. So now it's strange that you take probably sort of like the sort of, I've not seen enough of the TV show, but I would imagine that probably the sort of like the worst of society and put them on a pedestal and celebrate that.
But even before that TV show, I mean, you know, Harry Enfield, or like, I don't know if he's just a cockney,
I think Essex has got personality, you know, which, I think it's good to be from somewhere that has a personality, because at least it's remembered. You know, I used all the horrible Essex girl jokes and all that, but it was like, I don't know, you don't get, I don't know whether Buckinghamshire has a sort of, you know, sort of jokes made, but I'd rather be sort of like, have a joke made about me than be sort of widely ignored.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're wearing today a Bobby's Oysters t-shirt.
Yes.
Yeah, she says East Anglia. Bobby, our mutual friend, who is the purveyor of the finest shucked oysters.
Exactly. Bobby Banjo, we played together, music together for many years. We still do.
Is he your manager, or was he your manager at one
point? No, banjo player. Okay. Yeah, yeah. We travelled together. We was quite a sort of... We toured the world, basically, because we're just a unit, just the two of us. You know, we don't really need any looking after, so we never travelled with tour managers or you know, never had a manager or anything like that. Just the two of us in a car, you know, keep it cheap and, you know, keep going.
Banjos and oysters.
Yeah, banjos. It's a good man. Yeah, he's a hero. A
Okay, and last true or false, the first song you wrote was called Fish.
That is true. Yeah, that's in my book. Yeah.
It is in your book. Not that I've done my research or something. Okay, cool. So we're here to talk about festivals, obviously, but we're going to talk about anything. And, you know, off air before, Jay said, is there anything that we can't talk about? And absolutely, you know, it's open season here in the Debank podcast studio. So, man, you go for it. Anything is allowed. So festivals are the best thing since sliced bread. Discuss.
I mean, I can't remember a time before sliced bread, so I can't imagine what sort of change in the world that made. But I think festivals were the best thing before sliced bread as well. There was definitely, people were gathering en masse, you know, and dancing around campfires and kind of getting intoxicated long before bread.
I mean, yeah, our mutual friend Mr. Tofu touched on that last week or the week before and said... you know, he talked about the kind of pagan side of it and the ritualistic side of
it. It probably predates language, doesn't it? You know, I think when we was turning into whatever, you know, however the human race came to be the sort of complicated species that we are, I reckon it started off with, you know, drums and fires and dancing. And, you know, festivals still have that feeling too. I think there's still something really primal about festivals, even the kind of, you know, the big sort of like all singing, all dancing, sort of like with the sound systems and the lights. There's still something ultimately primal about people getting together and kind of, you know, just losing their shit a little bit. And I think that's what a lot of the draw is as well.
Maybe it was just a way of cavemen keeping warm, and they were sort of like jumping up and down, hugging themselves. Yeah, like,
and that's left in our DNA somehow. So we're kind of doing it. We don't know why it makes so much sense now, but, you know, it was just, yeah. One caveman. The caveman that survived was the sort of dancing warm caveman, something like that.
Yeah, we're his bearded descendants.
Exactly.
Well, not so much bearded for me. So what was your first festival that you went to?
Glastonbury.
Yeah.
Actually, I litter picked at a V festival before I ever went to a festival, after the festival had finished, and it was a horror show.
I like the way the fact you admit to that. It's not just keeping it cool like the kids who say their first ever record was by The Clash. It's like, yeah, I litter picked
it. Yeah, it was, I mean, I didn't really know what a festival was, and I just went and saw it. It wasn't even during the festival. It was like, you know, cheap sort of cash in hand work at V, you know, in Chelmsford, which is near where I grew up.
You didn't even get to see Kasabian or...
It was like Pulp and stuff like that. So I knew, I kind of, when I got there, I was like, what is this? And I was walked through the car park and was like picking up a few crisp packets. I was like, this is right. And then turned around to in front of the main stage and it was like, yeah, like a horror show, this mess. And I was just like, who the hell has made this mess? And, you know, next time I want to be here when they're making it, you know, rather than just clearing up afterwards. And it was, but I don't think I left that being like, I left that with almost a kind of not very nice feeling about festivals, but then in turn went to Glastonbury. And,
did you find anything exciting in the rubbish?
No, I think it was one of those where I was like, instantly, when I saw the rubbish, one thing I thought, I was like, I'm going to find those stuff. You know, I'm going to find some drugs and money. And I think I found like 40p. And my mate who was with us found 20 quid, and that was it. And it was like,
disappointing.
Yeah, right. I mean, the whole, actually, I couldn't stand it. It ended up, that litter pick, and ended up behind, I guess, what had been like a stall selling curry, then that had like full, like, metal bins of old curry that had fallen over, and those people, kids were basically like wading in it, picking up handfuls and putting handfuls of curry into black bin eyes. And I was I'm out of here, guys. Can I just cash out? I sort of wrote that off. I kind of came back to that memory long after my love affair with festivals had begun. My first festival was Glastonbury in 97. I was 16 years old. And I went by myself, ultimately. I got a ride down with an older kid that probably didn't want me to hang out with him once we got there. And I went a week early, even then. That was just because that was when the ride was going. And I lost my... we camped in Glastonbury Town before we went to to the festival. And I spent all my money, lost my tent, and then went to the festival.
And was that pre-Big Fence, or was that around?
It was way pre-Big Fence, yeah. But it was, in fact, that was the only ticket to Glastonbury that I ever bought, was that first one. And I bought it off a girl who lived down the end of the road. And I walked in accidentally without showing it to anybody. And
wish you hadn't bought it.
Well, then I turned around, I got a stamp on my hand, and went out and sold it to a ticket tout. Not that, and I've changed a lot of my views over the years.
Here we go.
Not
that
I believe the ticket tout is a good thing.
Apologising to Michael Eavis.
Yeah. Well, this was 97. I mean, after that, you know, for the next 3 or 4 years, I basically went back and told my mates it's free. You know, and we just went for free up until the fence did go up, and then I started working at Glastonbury. You know, still, I'd fell in love with it so much that once the fence was up, it was just like, well, you know, how else do we go? And where there's a will, there's a way.
Absolutely. Okay, well, we'll come back to Glastonbury, like I keep saying, but because I'm interested in what you were talking about before. Your first experience was litter picking at V. And, you know, litter is obviously a hot topic for a lot of the right reasons. And, you know, well, every reason is right on it. And I was just listening to your track this morning, Bamboo Toothbrush, which is, you know, all about
plastic pollution.
Writing, yeah, plastic pollution, 8 million tons of plastic going in the sea. You know, you're writing with ink from a plastic pen, you're going to, you know, replace that with a pencil, you're going to brush your teeth with a bamboo toothbrush. Yeah. I love that. What's the lyric about bananas with a disposable coat?
I can't remember that was the actual line. It's about, you know, shrink wrapping bananas in plastic, which is crazy. You know, I've seen a polystyrene packet of banana and then like cling film over the top. And it's like, this is literally a fruit designed, you know, by nature with a completely biodegradable packet. It's like, so the one thing it doesn't need is plastic and polystyrene packaging. And it's amazing that, I mean, you know, these are everywhere around the world. It's like, how can someone not just put their hand up and go, this is a silly idea? You know, like, we can... bananas are an ingenious invention. It's crazy that people can mess it up that much.
Although I have been corrected, I think, by my son, who, when I've not necessarily been trying to throw a banana skin out the window, but he said, oh, Dad, you know, it's 25 years to... it's some crazy amount, isn't it, for a banana skin to...
I don't think we should, you know, leave them on other people's front doorsteps. They're not ultimately going to do
just
any harm.
Covering my tracks here.
Yeah.
Just so when people... you shouldn't tell people to throw away their bananas.
Please don't throw... I mean, you know, still dispose of it correctly. But I think it's just not going to stay around forever, basically. But I think the problem with litter at festivals and, you know, and the sort of plastic waste and the whole conversation about people taking tents home and stuff like that is, you know, a huge problem that needs to be discussed by festivals. But it's basically just mirroring the larger problems that happen in the world. And I think a lot of festivals can be a kind of microcosm of life, can't they? You know, you basically create this world, and that sometimes it's easier to fix problems in a smaller world than you can then take onto a larger perspective. And so it's great that festivals are kind of waking up to it. At the same time, the world is waking up to it. But it's there's still a long way to go, basically. You know, people still drop rubbish in the streets they live, you know. People and they do that at festivals and they do it at home. And please don't.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This is Rob DeBank's A to Z of Festivals. Subscribe now and please remember to rate. So yeah, we were just on litter and shit like that. So you just ended at a nice place. So yeah, I mean, it seems like yeah, obviously all the festival promoters are trying to do their bit. Mm-hmm. Festival goers, you know, obviously, you know, it's, the onus is on them as well.
Definitely,
to not drop
yeah.
the stuff in the first place. We need to clear it up. But.
And I think there's sort of different levels of litter picking, isn't there? There's clearing up after yourself, and there's also that kind of. Telling other people to clear up after themselves, that kind of like, oh mate, you just dropped this, and like, oh, I didn't actually, yeah, it was empty. It's like, well, don't leave it here. And then there's the third level, which is actually just picking up other people's rubbish.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I used to get in trouble every year at the early festivals. I was when people weed in the hedges or against a fence, and I'd just take such sort of umbrage with it, probably because it was our festival, but also you know, I just it really sort of annoyed me. So yeah, people dropping litter or having a wee, and eventually I was just told, don't keep doing that, Robbie, because you're just going to get punched in the face. Because I just
or pissed on,
yeah, or pissed on, or both at the same time. But which is some people pay for. But okay, so we've done first festival, we've done messy festivals. What's your kind of worst festival experience? And I mean, yeah, we're talking about drunk folk stories by the man himself, Beans on Toast, and there are some quite good ones in here.
I was racking my brains for festival stories, actually, and there's one which, I mean, I had a great time.
Hold on, we just said worst festival
stories. Well, I had a great time. I had a great time, but telling the story probably doesn't paint me in the nicest of lights. But I'll share it with you anyway. So
and then I'll edit it out if I don't like it.
If you don't like it, yeah. It was a year. It must have been around 2009, 2010. It was the year that Mumford were playing. They was on their sort of their rise, basically. And I was working at a pub in Kentish Town at the time. I was supposed to be the manager of this bar. We'd sort of launched it, and things were going okay. But anyway, I wasn't going to go to Best of All. And I definitely not, yeah, not going to go. Friday night, ended up doing an all-nighter with this girl that worked behind the bar. And then come the morning, I was like, come on, let's just go. Let's just sod it. Let's just get a train and go to Best of All. And I tapped up the Mumford boys, see if they'd be able to get us in, which they said, yeah, come down. And then somehow, so it was a bit of a bendy morning, shall we say, but we got on the train, me and this girl, and in the midst, she was like, I don't really have any money. And I was like, look, don't worry, we'll just get, it's best not to take anything. We won't take a tent. We'll do it how, you know, this is how we roll at festivals. Somehow, I think I even said, what money have you got? We'll put it in the pot, and then we'll just share everything. And so, and then her phone ran out of battery, and we went down to Best of All, got in, saw one of Mumford's management lot. They got us in, and I think we'd been there like 10 minutes and I lost this girl. And I realised then that, you know, she hadn't slept, she didn't have any money or a phone or a tent or any means of getting back or anything. And
you know, I looked, but at the end of the day, and I was like, we've got to stop looking and stuff. I was also pretty blitzed myself, and
she probably had the best weekend of her life. If you're out,
no, there, it didn't work like that.
You see her afterwards?
No, I got a Facebook message from her. It gets worse. So she was just like, she said she. I think she woke up in like the not the hospital, but the sort of medic tent or whatever. Yeah, and she didn't really like, and I had to explain that she had no means of getting back. Blah blah. And I think a friend had to drive down and pick her up. And then I'd also said that she'd be fine. She didn't have to work the next day at the pub, and I didn't tell the other manager that. So when she got back, she got fired from the bar. And I, you know, we've made peace. But and I
are
did
you still
look,
friends?
Yeah. Wow. I'd seen her for a long time. Probably since that day. I'm not going to say names for her. but I was also that was probably, you know, as much. I was so not with it that day that I'd somehow thought that. So Mumford were about to do their big. Big festival show. And I said to Marcus, I was like, maybe I could just get up and do a couple of tunes during the gig. And he was like, obviously laughed it off, like, yeah, great idea. And I was like, I took that as a go.
Really?
So I had my guitar and I was like, tuned up.
Side of stage.
I was literally at the side of the stage, tuned up, and the tour manager was like, Jay, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm going to go on and do a couple of tunes. And he was like, what are you talking about? I was like, I'm going to go on and do a couple of tunes. And he was like, there's no way in the world that is happening. He was like, look at you, you can hardly stand up. And I was like, Marcus said it was right. And he was like, he was joking. He was like, I'm not even going to lay you on the stage. And kind of booted me off to the front. And that's probably not one of my finest hours. But other times, Mumford have stopped their songs and let me do a tune.
I mean, well, let's talk about the Mumford connection, because it was in 2009 that you put out a 50 track double album.
That's it, yeah.
And that was produced by Ben
from
Ben, Mumford.
Ben, keyboard player in Mumford and Sons, he did that. And it was like, just you know, I just knew him from playing gigs with him and loved the band like everybody did. And Ben, you know, he was living at his parents' house at the time, and he had some recording equipment, and I needed to do an album, so it was quite casual. It was just like, I'll do it. We did it in a weekend in his parents' loft, just 50 tracks, just one track, one take, bang, yeah, next, what else you got, bang, just did it like that.
And
loads of people,
and he just kind
in.
Of totally spontaneously didn't even know you were going to record. Were you just making them up on the spot?
No, I think I wrote one on the day, because I was like, I counted all my songs and I had 49 and I was like, I'll just write another one and we'll just round it up to 50. And then, you know, Ben just produced my last album as well, A Bird in the Hand, you know, 10 years later, where a lot has changed. And he basically snuck us into the Church Studios in Crouch End, which is Paul Letworth's studio, one of the best studios in the world, basically. And when no one was looking, we recorded the newest album there.
Yeah. So I was going to say, you know, Mumford obviously, you know, started off on tiny little folky band and then became, you know, huge stadium.
Sure, yeah.
Hard hitters, and in all that time they have, you know, they've run their record label, they've
kept it real, 100% kept it real, and always looked after other bands. They've running their own. I've done a lot of their Gentlemen of the Road festivals as well, which are incredible events. I've done mostly out in the States. I did one in New Jersey, where talking to people that from New Jersey, just because I had an English accent, they thought I was like something to do with the festival, even though I was like playing two songs. But people were in tears in New Jersey because they were so in love with the event that had come, because it had recently been hit by the hurricane and stuff. And it was like, it was in Seaside Heights was the place. And it had a couple of rough years. And then like Mumford come and brought this sort of like 2-day event to it. And the guy that ran the hotel was literally like thanking me and kind of crying. And I was like, yeah, anytime,
just taking all the credit.
Yeah. I did pass it on, but...
Yeah, so I was going to say, leading on from that, you know, UK versus US festivals. Obviously, the US market is kind of a bit newer, I think it's fair to say, despite, you know, Woodstock and, you know, all of that massive early history. And then it's got some incredible, you know, the big, you know, the Coachellas and the Bonnaroos, and a really good thriving sort of scene coming through. But is it, I mean, you know, for starters in America, you drive in, don't you? And you pitch your tent next
exactly
to your car.
That, yeah, which is super weird. I've not done a huge amount. I've did Bonnaroo years ago, and I kind of blagged it, basically. I didn't really have a gig. I just kind of like went in on the blag and got a couple. I did Electric Forest, which is in Michigan, and they have a a nice diverse mix of acts. I'd say the positive sides of American festivals, they have a great diverse mix of acts. Certainly the Electric Forest had like the String Cheese Incident, which I thought were like an old kind of wig out sort of band playing free sets. They for one of them was 3 hours to a bunch of like 18, 19 year olds that then would hang around and watch Bass Nectar, which was pretty impressive. And it was a lot cleaner. They drop a lot less rubbish in the States.
That is true.
Which is, you know, as we were just saying. But at the same time, I still feel a little bit, I don't feel at home as I do at, you know, at a UK festival.
No.
And it does feel a little bit, it feels a little bit like my first festival, which, you know, I'm old and jaded, you know, like, and why shouldn't everybody have their first festival? But that's probably a good thing. But for me, you know, like, it's easier when, you know, I know the guy at the ice cream stand or whatever. It sort of just adds to the kind of the story of my weekend.
All right, well, let's go. Let's just run through a few of the festivals that you're a regular at or you have played at, and add in your own ones at your will. Boomtown.
Boomtown, I had a beautiful relationship with them where I first played in 2012 and on like a poetry stage before they had any sort of folk music or whatnot. And it was like in what was the Wandering Word, so in the middle of the forest, and it was just this huge turnout. I think it surprised me, surprised everybody, and I think of because it was such a, you know, a sort of rave, you know, it still is, but very much then it was like much more of a rave, and it was like, I think everybody was like wanted to come and hear a G chord and someone sing a little bit, and it just was sort of descended upon it, and it just turned into, it was like a roadblock in the forest. It was amazing. And it's also, you know, I, as much as you can't really dance to my songs, I like to think I sing songs to people that like dancing. So it, something clicked, and it was like, this is, I really sort of found my music found a bizarre home in the crowd at Boomtown. And then as Boomtown grew, they kind of had these stages that were, you know, especially for folk music and stuff. And so I do the same time slot now. I've been doing Old Minds 3 o'clock on Sunday, which has turned into a kind of a thing. You know, again, repetition. A lot of the things I do is just be consistent.
First releasing gig at Glastonbury, 3 p.m. Boomtown.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, so Old Minds is done now and I've been moved to Town Centre this year at Boomtown. But again, you know, very, it's just such a lovely crowd to play to. And yeah, it's just wicked. Homecoming. Sort of. Yeah, and I kind of confirm myself every year on stage just by going, I'll see you next year, same time, same place, Boomtown. And
Captain's
Captain seems to let that keep on rolling. Yeah, yeah. So.
Okay, endorse it.
Oh, wow, that's going back some years. I used to work for Strummerville, the charity, and we used to do a campfire at Endorse It. It's gone now. But yeah, that was a kind of...
Sum up the music. That was like Pronghorn.
It was like,
and...
Yeah, it's like Krusty Punks, wasn't it? It was well cidery, you know, and then like cross dressing on the Sunday. Yeah, it was kind of
hold on, you can't just gloss over that. Cross dressing on the Sunday.
Well, it was like you know, like a lot of great festivals have the dress up down Sunday. I think like there's the sort of Somerset cider punks aren't really willing to put much work into that, but they could all get their hands on like a dress. So they'd all just, I don't, there wasn't much, it didn't go both ways really, the cross-dressing. It was mainly just like mainly big clothes. Hairy dudes in like tight-fitting dresses.
Do you think it was Dorset, not Somerset? In Dorset.
Oh yeah, Dorset. But they was definitely Somerset side of punks as a genre. Yeah.
It's a county, it's fine. Yeah. Why Not Festival?
Yeah, another regular for me. Always a big sort of like big tent, really young crowd, really up for it. Again, consistency. I think this year initially I wasn't booked, and there was a bit of a sort of like online uproar, and then the kind of call came in, which thanks guys, brilliant. I mean, that's because a lot of people
power.
Yeah, a lot of people write to me like, why don't you play this festival? Why don't you play that festival? Or can you come here and play? And it's like, I wish that I did get to choose, you know, like, but never underestimate the power of asking the festival. If they can, because they'll listen, you know, and they're the ones sitting around going, right, who do we want? Who do people want? So these, you know, and this doesn't, not just for me, for anybody listening, if there's, you know, if there's a band that you want to play a festival that you're going at, obviously it's nice.
You're
you know,
some more gigs for this summer, yeah?
Well, I'm always up for a gig, man. Always up for a gig.
And I mean, when you get on stage at these festivals, do you look out and see regulars? You know, see people that you kind of...
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. People from the gigs and stuff as well. Yeah, you know, and I know a lot of people that come to my gigs regularly. Yeah. You know, and I know them as friends as well.
I mean, you're an amazing performer, and you know, live you're totally at home, almost, you know, probably not more than the records, but you're a live performer, you know, one of those people that is just totally comfortable on stage. So I'm a very uncomfortable live performer, and you know, when I'm DJing, I'm like head down up until probably half an hour, and then I'm like, I start making eye contact. But you know, like just getting into your mind when you walk on that stage, do you ever get the sort of heebie-jeebies and just go, oh god, this is like too much, look at the sky or something, or are you always just like...
No, it's like I'm like the... I always just want to do the gig, like as much as I love, you know, I love being at festivals for lots of reasons. I love watching other bands, but when it, you know, ultimately I'm there for my gig, you know, and it's like, and half hour before, a lot of the times, because you get like half an hour allocated sound check, and it's like, I don't need half an hour to sound check. Chances are I just go, like, let's just go, you know, yeah, I'll just play for a bit longer. We can just start.
I've broken all my strings. We can just start now.
Yeah, we can just start now. But yeah, I'm just, you know, I'm looking forward to it, and you know, when I'm up there, I'm enjoying it. So yeah.
But do you actually sort of look out and make eye contact?
Yeah, I think when you're singing, yeah, definitely. I think over the course of a gig, I'll generally like hone in on like a couple of people that you kind of keep on going back to. Again, it's not something that I ever put much thought into, and the last thing you want on stage is think, oh, where am I looking? If you know what I mean? It's
remember the lyrics.
Yeah, you will sometimes. But it's better just to kind of just sort of be free flowing. But I definitely do, you know, like I'll hone in on some people. I think no one, it's quite weird looking at a crowd, because no one, if you're looking right at someone, they don't know that you're looking right at them. Because it's like, oh, right. And everybody's like, everybody thinks you're looking right at them as well, because you're kind of moving around. But yeah, I'll definitely hone in, and I'll see if I can, you know, I'll see if people that aren't liking it and see if they change their mood. I mean, one of my favourite things is when you sort of drop a line and you see someone with their mate, like, oh, yeah, like, you know, like, tap them out, oh, that's a good line, or whatever. Yeah, yeah, that's, yeah.
You know, you've got a fan in the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
Any mental things happen to you when you've been on stage? You know, things thrown at you or...
I mean, not at a festival, but at a gig in Cleveland, a live chicken appeared on stage.
Right.
Which is, you know, I mean, I've got a lot of songs about chickens. Chicken happens to be my power animal. I was playing, it was like quite a small club, but busy, and I just noticed the whole crowd were just looking up down, basically. Everyone was quite high stage, and everyone was like looking down towards my ankles, and I looked down, and there's just like this petrified chicken just there, just like, just shitting itself. And I was like, I didn't really know what to do. I tried to grab it. I'm not brilliant with stuff like that, so I tried to grab it. The chicken got away and just got more scared. It was with on tour with Skinny Lister, and Michael, the bass player, just sort of grabbed the chicken and took it into the dressing room. But we never got to the bottom of it. I was like, look, does someone want to claim this chicken? And we didn't. We orphaned it off. We couldn't take it on tour with us. So it's like, we was just like, we need to do something with it. No one was taking responsibility for it. So some guy was like, I can take it and, you know, like, find a home
hopefully.
For it. But it wasn't, this wasn't alive. This was in like central Cleveland in the city. It was like weird.
Okay, so live venues, like you're talking about opening your recyclable clean bottle there, no single use plastic on Beans's Rider. That's good to see. So city venues or indoor music venues versus playing on a stage at a festival.
I think that my act as such, you know, is born from festivals, and that's where it started, and that's what I love doing. But a gig is a gig, you know, I love them all. And once I get going, they all feel very similar, be it, you know, in a pub to two people or, you know, in a tent to 2,000. Mm. I think they actually support each other really well. Playing at festivals, you play to lots and lots of new people, and you do the kind of like full power, you know, presuming that people haven't heard you kind of set.
Yeah.
And then people that like that then in turn come and buy a ticket to see you, you know, play in their town later in that year, and then you're playing to people that, you know, have listened to the music and a bit more kind of are already on board, and you can therefore do a different show. So the two, you know, touring and festivals for me personally, go hand in hand, and that's why I continue to do them year in, year out.
Yeah, and for the listeners who are tuned in thinking, I like this guy, Beans on Toast, obviously a lot of you probably hardcore fans already, get his book, Drunk Folk Stories. We were just saying off air while I was changing the mic over during a slight technical hitch that
sounded much better now.
You're actually, yeah, I mean, you've published this yourself.
Yeah.
You were just saying with your, now you're sort of putting out your own music. It's very much a cottage industry. You said your mum and dad are sort of involved.
Yeah, big up to Derek and Pauline. Yeah,
Derek and Pauline.
They do all the, they send out all the merch. So if you buy a t-shirt or a book, that comes from D&P Distribution out there in Essex.
There you go.
So,
do they like Beans on Toast? Eating it?
I don't know. That comes to a lot of gigs. They like the gigs, but yeah, I'm sure they eat it from time to time.
Yeah, yeah. But so you were saying you're really happy kind of doing everything DIY, independent.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I worked with a great label for many years, you know, I wouldn't be able to be doing what I am doing without them. You know, and I work with...
Big shout out to Extra Mile.
Yeah, and work with Adam at This Is Now Agency, you know, who, you know, I'm not an island, if you know what I mean. Like, there's certainly a lot of people around, but... You know, I think the future of there was. I think old school music industry involved a lot of middlemen, didn't it? And I think, like, and certainly what I'm doing, there's not really, you know, there's not even a big enough pie to share, you know. So, and that's not me being greedy. It's just, you know, it's just sort of a way that means I can continue to do what I love.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, just to end on festivals, you know, we've talked about green issues, litter, talked about playing, you know, the live experience. What? How do you see the future of festivals? I know that's kind of a crazy, big, open-ended question, but how they've evolved in the last sort of 15, 20 years.
Yeah, I think that it's good. You know, I think the future of festivals looks really good. I think there'll be more and more kind of band-curated festivals, I reckon, like Mumford's General of the Road, Frank Turner's Lost Evening, stuff like that. I think with the promoters, some, you know, getting a headliner is difficult. So if you are a headliner, then why not build a festival from there down? And, you know, I think that offers something nice. I think niche festivals, you know...
cheese rolling festivals.
Yeah, stuff like that. I mean, I don't know much about cheese rolling. No. But also, I think, like...
Oyster and Banjo Festival.
I think that there's definitely a kind of like the next wave that will come from the youth as well. I think there's definitely a kind of how the digital world will interact with festivals, which I'm sure to people like me and you and kind of, you know, the children of Glastow will kind of hate the idea of a digital sort of virtual reality festival. But at the same time, you know, I laughed at online dating when that, you know, that used to be a kind of like an embarrassment.
Niche activity.
Yeah, an embarrassment. And now it's Tinder, you know. It's like, so I'm sure that will happen. Also think, you know, going, speaking to a man just halfway through the Yuval Noah Harari book, but really far in the future where it's like, you know, when it's quite a sort of hot topic at the moment, when AI explodes and the kind of this useless class is invented, so there's like people don't need to work anymore, and there's just this, basically it's going to kind of end in war unless they can find a way of kind of appeasing the masses. And, you know, like, I think a party could be a better answer than a war, you know, because people can find reason and meaning, you know, for a weekend at, you know, at best of all, searching for the big top or following the guy with the yellow cape to get the wristband, or, you know, sort of like create these sort of like narratives and meanings that, you know, for a weekend, that I'd certainly rather do that than get blown up by a sort of pilotless drone.
There we go. Maybe watch out for the Beans on Toast versus Rob DeBank Endless Utopia 365 day a year festival coming soon.
Boom, coming in 2029.
Thank you so much, Jay. Thank you, Rob. Beans on Toast, get his book Drunk Folk Stories out now on Play on Words Publishing. Thanks, man, and see you out in the field.
See you then.
This is Rob DeBank's A to Z of Festivals. Subscribe now and please remember to rate.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.